Okay, so I thought I'd read again from Ajahn Manindo's Unexpected Freedom, a talk called Alone Together. And it starts with the Dhammapada verse 205. Tasting the flavor of solitude and the nectar of peace, those who drink the joy that is the essence of reality abide free from fear of evil. Question. Can you explain the relative merits of practicing as a monastic and practicing as a householder? Could you also describe any general patterns of personality change that you've noticed in people as a result of Buddhist practice? Ajahn Manindo, whether one lives the life of a celibate renunciate, as a monk or a nun, or whether one lives as a layperson, a householder, is a question of one's own choice of lifestyle. That choice is not just about personal preferences, but has to do with all sorts of conditions, our accumulations, our karma. It is a basic premise of the Buddhist outlook that we did not come into the world as a blank sheet, but with a history and a set of tendencies. What we came into this life with forms the context and background against which our life's unfolding takes place, the details of which most of us can't see. For all of us, however, monks, nuns, and lay people, the practice is essentially the same. We all encounter frustration, limited existence, and suffering. What matters is whether we are willing to receive our suffering consciously and look into the actuality of it, or whether we are committed, knowingly or unknowingly, to distraction and avoidance in order to delay looking at that which is truly taking place. In both the householder's life and the monastic life, there is the full spectrum of commitment, from those who are enthusiastically committed to seeing what the reality of each moment is, to those occupied in distraction. What matters is whether our lifestyle is true for us and whether it helps us to develop increased willingness. Willingness is what matters. The reality, whatever our choice of lifestyle, is that throughout our life, we have to face the evidence of our limitations. Whether we like it or not, we all experience not getting our way and becoming lost in habitual reactivity. When we come right up against these experiences, how do we respond? Do we resist saying, I shouldn't be this way. I should be more clear about where I'm going in my life. Or is there the heartfelt capacity to meet this person, me, in this experience of limitation in an unobstructed way? Then subtitled, Encountering Loneliness. To speak personally, I can say that living as a monk has been a difficult choice, but I don't have any regrets. I do regret some of the ways I have handled certain situations in the past, but I don't regret having chosen to live the life of a monk. I feel very privileged and fortunate to live this life, and the longer I live it, the more that feeling grows. It's fundamentally about living in solitude and getting to know your aloneness. Yes, monks live together in community, but in our togetherness, we are alone. The structures of the life brings us into intense recognition of our aloneness and the agony of loneliness. For someone who lives the monastic life of a celibate renunciate, loneliness is not considered as a symptom of failure. It's looked upon as an indicator, a sign. Where you feel the pain of loneliness is horrible, is just as it is, it does not mean failure. This feeling tells you where your resources are, where you need to get your gold. It is something that we train ourselves to welcome and to look into. We are supposed to feel lonely, at least until we realize contentment in our aloneness. From this perspective, compulsive socializing or any heedless activity that distracts us from an accurate personal receptivity to the experience of loneliness is seen as a hindrance. There are monastic communities in both Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions in which there are movements toward socializing and group activity. But according to my understanding and the observation of these things, inevitably, either these activities die out or the communities themselves die. The reason is that the monastic life is essentially solitary. It's all about being alone. The decision to live such a life is made for all sorts of reasons, but ultimately it needs to be made because we find it in our nature to make that choice. It's not right or wrong to live the monastic life or the householder's life. We choose whatever is appropriate for our condition, whatever supports us in our commitment to the path of practice. Anyone who has lived the life of a monk, nun, or a postulant for any length of time knows the pain of loneliness, but hopefully has also tasted the benefit of being supported by a spiritual community in their encounter with it. The spiritual community is very important support in encouraging us to go deeper into all aspects of our experience, perhaps our loneliness even more than other aspects. To try to live monastically without any support would be very difficult. Because of this, the Buddha encouraged the spiritual community, the Sangha, to make a shared commitment to a celibate renunciate lifestyle and to support each other in their efforts. If we have adequately prepared ourselves with the strength of mindfulness and steadiness of samadhi, along with the self-respect that comes from sense restraint and moral conduct, then we can embrace the energetic reality of loneliness. Instead of feeling, "I feel lonely, what can I do to get rid of this feeling of loneliness?" I'll write an email, read a book, or ring somebody up. We open up to receive, without any judgment or analysis, the feeling of loneliness. To be encouraged to do that is a wonderful thing, and it is very much a part of the spiritual community, what a spiritual community is about. As a householder or layperson, it is not necessarily the case that you'll be forced to confront loneliness in the same manner as a monk or nun will be. Living with a partner in a committed relationship, for example, in many cases with children as well, brings a very different experience altogether. Assuming that such a relationship is not destructive or dysfunctional, there will be a sense of companionship, close, intimate companionship. Since the last close, intimate companionship I had was about 30 years ago, there's little I can say about that. But from what people tell me, committing to a close relationship doesn't protect anyone from the pain of loneliness. So whatever your lifestyle choice, all of us who are committed to practice are called to go deeper into this experience and find our way to a resolution. Personality shifts. With regards to changes in personality through practice, nowadays what I see in everybody who is training, whether monastic or lay people, is a shift in heart towards an increased willingness to receive the present moment in its fullness, without interpretation, indulgence, or avoidance. In any experience, our mind can imagine all sorts of possible outcomes, some agreeable and some disagreeable. We can become very anxious because of these imagined possibilities. However, if we practice rightly and truly, we find ourselves increasingly capable of accommodating all sorts of eventualities, both the frightening and the wonderful. I have found this to be true throughout my years of training and have observed it growing in many with whom I have lived. Witnessing such increase of capacity is always a joy. I've received a letter today from someone who lives in Eastern Europe and has been practicing for a few years. He's young and very enthusiastic in his practice and has just recognized that he's been attached to the conceited view that he is in the best religion. There is nobody in his family and hardly anybody else in the immediate environment who is Buddhist, so he's very much a solitary Buddhist. He's been holding on to an idea of himself as a Buddhist in a very tight way, which is quite understandable. That's generally how we all begin. But because of his right practice, he has reached a point where he started to loosen the way he holds the perception of himself as a Buddhist, and has come to realize how conceited his view was that I am a Buddhist, and Buddhist is the best religion there is. In his letter, he described how, having seen his conceit, he became caught up in terrible doubt. He thought, "I've been brainwashed. Buddhism is just another system of brainwashing." He wrote that he'd been watching a video on Nazis in Germany in the 1930s, in which the Nazi youth were going around teaching the young people to sing nationalistic songs praising Hitler and so on. The Nazis were skilled in programming large number of people to hold specific views and beliefs, to conform to fixed ideas. Seeing this video coincided with him recognizing how rigid his grasp on Buddhism was, he fell into this hellish doubt in which he decided that he had been thoroughly mistaken and that Buddhism was, in fact, just a load of codswallop. This is just another form of programming for imbeciles, he thought to himself, believing that he'd made a terrible and humiliating mistake. Fortunately, his practice was adequately balanced so that he was soon able to reflect on the shift in his experience and on the doubt that he was caught up in. The reality of his experience was that he was having doubts, that's all. He didn't know that Buddhism was a load of codswallop. He didn't know that he'd been programmed into believing some cultic nonsense. His practice was sufficiently broad, non-judgmental, and here and now, in that he was able to accommodate his doubt without grasping it, without becoming it. If in that moment, when the thoughts arose, I'm just being programmed by a cult of fanatic monks and Ajahn Mahindra as another sort of Nazi, if he hadn't been properly prepared, then he could have thrown the whole thing out the window, gone out drinking with his mates, and created a whole lot of unskillful karma. I'm impressed with the way this young man went through this period on his own, allowing the doubts to be there. He allowed the real possibility that he'd gotten it all wrong to remain in his consciousness without losing the balance of his mind. His willingness to experience the doubt took him through to some insights into the nature of doubting. As we continue in the practice of Buddha Dhamma, we find increased willingness to accommodate all sorts of possibilities that come to us. We don't jump to conclusions so readily, and because of this, the heart and mind begins to expand in a more open and easeful way. By our practice of restraint, we find that there are more, not fewer, possibilities. Practitioners become more relaxed, they become more trusting. This is the sort of personality change you might expect from practice. Certainly my experience has been that, instead of having to feel sure about things, I am able to let myself be not so sure. Sometimes people tell me that when I talk, I sound very sure and confident, but that is not necessarily my subjective experience. When I talk about Dhamma, what I am concerned with is encouraging investigation. At the end of a Dhamma talk, I hope that the listeners have more and deeper questions than at the start. However, when I meet my brothers and sisters and their partners, who are all evangelical Christians, then I know that I am meeting people who are really sure. If they're not traveling the world as missionaries in Africa, Turkey, India, or the United States, they're preaching and running churches near home. They don't have any doubts at all, certainly not conscious ones. They are very much convinced that they have the answers. In that respect, we are worlds apart because I can't say I have the answers. I feel connected to a reality which is much bigger than me, something beyond delineations of inner and outer, a reality that I care about tremendously. And this is something that I wholeheartedly commit my life and service to, but I can't say that I know or that I'm sure. I welcome the state of uncertainty. I think it's a healthy condition. Not sure. As far as making right effort in daily life, accommodating family situations, community situations, and other people, I think this particular point is very relevant, recognizing that, in reality, we are not sure most of the time. That makes us much nicer people to be with. If out of fear of being unsure, we hold on to ideas and take fixed positions, we can become very rigid. If I feel sufficiently threatened in certain situations, a fear comes up, and there's an experience of contraction. A rigidity kicks in. And when that kicks in, possibilities become limited. My mind doesn't want to look at the myriads of possibilities, doesn't want to float around and feel what's actually going to fit. In that state of contraction and limitation, it wants to get something and feel sure. But this doesn't benefit me and doesn't benefit other people. On the other hand, when we are able to remember, we don't know what's going to happen, that we don't know for certain, then there's a relaxation, a releasing, an opening up, and a trusting, a reconnecting with a trusting relationship to life. Life is uncertain, but that is just the truth. We don't have to be in a perpetual state of fear because of it. There are many contemplations that aim at leading us into a trusting relationship to life, but I think this reflection on the fact that most of the time we don't know what is going to happen is especially useful. When the tendency to grasp out of fear or insecurity arises, if we have prepared ourselves, we hold back and just wait, remaining open at the same time in touch with our sense of not sure. This is one of Ajahn Chah's most regular teachings, perhaps his most regular teaching. Whatever you said to him after he responded, he would often add, "But mene, not sure." Ne, which comes from the Pali word Nietzsche, means permanent. In Thai, it means sure or certain. My is a negative. That was really the bottom line with all of his teachings. Whatever arrangements were being made, "We're going to do this," or "Next week I'm going to Bangkok," he would regularly say, "Mainer, not sure." But not because he lacked commitment, he was anything but wishy-washy, but because he wanted us to see the Dhamma in all of our activity. On the day that Ajahn Chah died in 1992, a friend of the monastery offered a lamp as a gift to mark the occasion. We switched this lamp on for the next 10 days and nights as a gesture of our respect. After this period, we held a memorial service in the Dhamma Hall here. A large gathering of people from Newcastle and the surrounding area came together for chanting and meditation, to reflect with gratitude on the teacher who had just passed away. At the memorial service, I read a talk from a collection of Ajahn Chah's teachings called Food for the Heart. It was on Ajahn Chah's favorite theme, impermanence. The words in this talk gained a new significance as I read them. When I came to this important passage, the key sentence in the whole talk, which says, quote, "And any teaching from any teacher that does not include the word impermanence," boom, then the light bulb blew. "Is not the teachings of the Buddha." I had to stop for a moment. I suppose these things happen, don't they? What causes them? What's actually going on? Who knows? But it certainly etched that particular aspect of Ajahn Chah's teachings even more deeply in my mind. Any teaching that does not contain the words "not sure" or "impermanence" is not the teachings of the Buddha. Thank you very much for your attention.
I'm grateful to hear that reading. As a householder, like yesterday, I was being overtaken by moods and thoughts, and I sort of marshaled myself to do more meditation, more reading. I'm going to the monastery to know that I'm not alone together.
Yeah, that's very much the case. We have to do the practice ourselves. We have to say we're born alone, we die alone, but there is this aspect of having good spiritual friendships, support, the external supports, other people, and that's an important foundation to be building our practice on. At the same time as we're getting used to the fact that
I'm curious if you have any advice in terms of, lately, since I can't do much walking meditation at all, it's been mostly sitting meditation and then reading things. And I'm just curious, the thought occurred to me, particularly looking through Ajahn Lee and the forest teachers, that they certainly didn't do so much reading. And I'm curious if you have any advice in terms of this. Basically, I find that if I slip into a bad mood, then I'll often just, there's lots of things to read, and I'm good at pulling myself out that way. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that sometimes it might be useful just to be in a bad mood for a while and learn how to live with that, learn what that's like.
Mm-hmm.
Any
Well, I mean, certainly, Ajahn Chah's encouragement, recommendation was, you know, if you have to read anything, learn how to read your heart. And certainly an important reminder to ourselves. The other side of the coin, or the other reality, is that with our upbringing and our conditioning and our education, to go cold turkey without any kind of reading is pretty difficult. So that a lot of it is, you know, on a certain level, it doesn't really matter. Do you read? Do you not read? Do you, what matters is whether one is doing reading or not doing reading, or whatever one's doing. Are you actually paying attention to what is the motivation? What's the feeling? What's the experience of this? We're really turning the mind and turning our attention to reflecting on what's behind this? What's going on? What is the experience? Am I suffering? And not am I miserable, but is the mind being driven by some kind of restlessness or dullness or annihilation or propping up the sense of self? But that has to be investigated. Because sometimes you can just take a position of being, I'm a person who doesn't read, and be able to fulfill that completely. But it doesn't mean you actually investigate your mind. And similarly, it can be. You can worry that I'm distracting myself, which you might be from time to time, but it's the investigation, the willingness to investigate. What's behind this? What's the motivation? What's the feeling? What's the experience? Is there a way out of this? What is the way out? What's the Dhamma principle behind this? So it's that investigation that's important.
This topic of loneliness is something I've ever, just not really a concept I think about too much, though I know it exists for me. I'm not sure if there's a question here exactly, but my own experience of that in the world was I was far more lonely in the world than I am in the monastery. And I think the primary thing I thought about and reflected on why that was, because it wasn't like I wasn't around people. I was in relationships, I had friends. But I think what it was, one of the things anyway, was the shared values.
Yeah.
And what I was pulled to and drawn to and dedicating my life to, even though I was around other Buddhists sometimes, it wasn't shared. Mm-hmm. And in the monastery, it usually is. And but I was also thinking, but there's also a loneliness here where not being in an intimate relationship, not going out every Friday, it's a different type of thing. So I found myself sort of agreeing with Ajahn in one parts and not totally agreeing in other parts, but I realized he's sort of speaking, he may not be talking about everything, talking about one specific part, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... Well, I mean, in a short talk, you can cover anything anyway. And there's that certain sense of covering or speaking from a particular perspective of the moment and considering that. But I think in general, what you said is also really important, that a lot of the things that pulled us to the monastery was, most of us, the world really wasn't living up to the advertising.
I think that's a great comment. Yeah. Face look, because it's like it's a, Ajahn Mahendra said, it's like when he gives a talk, it's like what he really hopes that he gets from it is that actually people have deeper questions than what he talked about. So it's like,
yeah.
He's bringing up I got interested in this talk because, like, it's not something. Yeah, I've only heard one or two talks on the subject in the 18 years I've been a monk, but it is it's part of our human condition.
Yeah. And also too, that similar, like, my primary motivation for coming here was community and being with people, shared values and so forth. But then I got to thinking about, like, also too, you know, that this paradox, like you say about, like, we have to do the work ourselves.
Yeah.
And so for me, like, the teaching that Ajahn Mahendra gave maybe pointed to, like, in the world, the kind of companionship that you might have discourages introspection.
Yes.
Whereas here, because I remember, like, at the beginning, you know, like, I was sad when monks that I had companionship with left the monastery to go to another community or went to Thailand or whatever. But recently, when monks have left, that I've actually been joyful, you know? And you're like, wow. I didn't feel the person anymore. What was I like? Like, I felt like it was, I mean, in short, it was mudita. Like, I felt so, you know, like, I had such a wholesome relationship with these people, but then at the same time, that didn't translate into, like, oh, woe is me, I'm losing my friends.
Right.
It was a more, I don't know if I'd call it loneliness, but it's more like an independence or stability from the inside.
Yeah.
So maybe
you see that growing as one continues to practice.
Yeah, I think loneliness is a very complex emotion. Like, we say loneliness, but there's so much happening there. I felt what I would call, like, the least lonely, like, during periods of retreat.
Okay.
Completely, like, that's the least lonely I've ever felt, but not around people at all.
Right.
And investigating, like, what is that? Like, for me, loneliness is like a want to be acknowledged or accepted or loved. And then in periods of retreat, I got all of that from my surroundings and from the kuti.
Okay. Was a friend of mine when I was first living in meditation centers in my early 20s. It asked me, like, do you ever get lonely there? Because you're not allowed to touch people, you're not allowed to really talk all that much. And I told her no. And I said, you never get lonely? And I was like, no. And it actually seemed like a strange question to me at the time, because I had a lot of the good spiritual companionship, and I felt like, you know, more close to some of the people there that I had ever felt close to. And I kind of kept thinking about that, of like, that I didn't really know what loneliness felt like, or at least, like, when she asked, it almost seemed like a foreign word. And then after, I don't know, a few more years, then I left the meditation center back in life, I kind of realized, like, or at least in my own, how I was making sense to it myself, it was like, that loneliness was like, it was clinging. It was like clinging to something when you don't have anything to cling to. Is that feeling of clinging to something when the object isn't there? And that kind of became a little bit clear to me that when I read something with the Dalai Lama, and the interviewer asked him, do you ever feel lonely? And the interviewer was kind of caught off guard because he wasn't even certain. The Dalai Lama was saying, well, yes. And you kind of feel, to take on compassion as like a real practice, like you're able to, like, open up and be vulnerable, and you always feel like you're surrounded by people that care about you. And then that was kind of even more confirmed when I was in a relationship, and the relationship ended, and I really felt like I knew what it felt to be lonely. Like, it was like you know, and even when I wasn't necessarily thinking of her, it was like this intense clinging to you know, anything. And so yeah, you can end loneliness by having something to cling to temporarily. But once that fades away, the loneliness comes right back, or kind of think you come out of it just by coming out of clinging.
Okay. Did you have something?
I was going to point out one image that I've always found so interesting is just like puja. Like we come together and we're together in a group, in a building, we're sharing the space, but we're all doing individual work, we're not talking to each other, which is not the usual worldly community at gathering.
Yeah.
It sure exemplifies the paradox of that.